That's Ricky Nelson. And Teenage Idol, 26 minutes after the hour. It is a Wednesday morning. We've surmounted our technical difficulties, and we managed to look out of the whole world to choose from. Somehow we zeroed in on Columbia, Maryland, and ran across Doug Greenwald this morning. Doug, good morning. Glad to have you along.
Thanks. It helps to have drones in your arsenal, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah. Doug, of course, the senior teaching fellow and executive director of Preserving Bible Times there in Columbia, Maryland, right next to Washington, D.C., where all the action is. And Doug and his ministry are all about context, the historic and cultural context of Scripture. And we look forward to Doug's conversations every Wednesday morning because we learn stuff. We learn a lot. And Doug, last week we were on our way to the woman at the well at last check. We were going to go into John 4, but comes Lent, which is a whole different series of events, a whole different kind of thinking. And so we decided last week we would kind of wait for Woman at the Well. We'll do that later. But we want to talk about the events that led up, you know, events marking the end of Jesus' ministry, his time here, and leading up to Passion Week in Jerusalem. Where's a good place to start that story?
Well, I typically, and historically and traditionally, John 11 sort of kicks off the nominally 40 days of Lent.
Mm-hmm.
It's the encounter, the raising of Lazarus, that sort of seals the deal for Jesus and makes sure that he is indeed going to die on a cross in the not too distant future. And so for me, this is the bookend. This is the first bookend, mm-hmm. John 11. And of course, the last bookend is the resurrection of this period of time that we know as Lent. And it's a fascinating story. It's what sets the whole Lenten period in motion, and that's what always fascinates me about it. And I thought it'd be a good place to start there, as we're a little bit into Lent now, but revisit how in the world did this whole thing get put on the rails.
Now, in my mind, I see the time toward the end of Jesus' 3 years of active ministry on the earth as he's kind of come from Galilee and marshaled his troops, the apostles, the followers, and headed back toward Jerusalem. Where is he physically now as we begin the story today?
That's a great question, because as you know, through the years, we always want to ask, where are we?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad to see you pick that up. He's in Perea. And for a lot of people, they just scratch their heads on that. But Perea lies east of the Jordan River in the Jordan River Valley. We're in late winter, probably late February. And it's cold at Jerusalem. 2,850 feet in the air, maybe some snow from time to time. And if you are a rabbi with an itinerant ministry, that means you're in an outdoor ministry. You're going to be where it's warm in the wintertime, and that is Perea, the Jordan Valley. It's sort of like, why in the world would anyone ever stay in Minnesota mm-hmm. in the wintertime when they could be in Palm Springs?
We kind of ask that ourselves now and then, yeah.
Every year.
I don't think you can ask that one enough.
Well, the thing is, I can't answer it. Why am I here?
I just asked that in July.
Well,
why am I here? What's the deal?
Perea is not precisely, it's in the Jordan River Valley, but it's somewhere north of Jericho, correct?
Well, we have to go east from Jerusalem
mm-hmm.
To go down what's known as the Wadi Kelt to get to Jericho. Jericho is on the west side of the Jordan River. Then we got to go a few miles, then we have to cross the Jordan River, and then we start to head north. So by the computations that we could do based on the information John gives us, Jesus is at least a two-day walk away from Bethany, which is a suburb of Jerusalem, when this story unfolds. Mm.
And he's there kind of in winter residence. I mean, he's there with his disciples. They've just kind of been chased out of Jerusalem, haven't they?
They have, because they've had some prior encounters, one with the Festival of Lights in late December, and the tensions are building. And Jesus probably has is about to have his facial resemblance put on every telephone pole, permit me this mm-hmm. sloppy analogy here,
mm-hmm.
for wanted. Where is he? We're looking for him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got Mary and Martha and Bethany and Lazarus, who's deteriorating, and we've got Jesus at least 2 days away, and Perea, and Lazarus is getting sicker and sicker. He's deteriorating, and the sisters say, we better send a messenger to Jesus. And so that's what they do.
Well, we've already established that Jesus was very close to this family. Now,
John tells us, in fact, he loved them, because mm-hmm. what Jesus is about to do would seem that he doesn't love them very much. Mm-hmm. He's probably stayed with them every time he's come to the Jerusalem area for major festivals. And, very good friends.
Do you suppose they had the expectation that he would come and heal Lazarus? Or was it simply that he's a close friend of the family, he should be here when Lazarus dies?
I suspect, we have to ask another question here. What's happened before that might well bear on this passage? And two events that I think really bring to bear on answering the question you just posed, what is the mindset of Mary and Martha, is they would have been very much aware of two people having been brought back to life on the same day, with Jesus being hands-on, in the physical presence of the person who was brought back to life. So that would have been the widow of Nain's only son from Luke 7. And it would have been the raising of Jairus' daughter, the president of the synagogue in Capernaum. Those two bringing back to lives were same day. Jesus is present and he's hands-on. And both of those would have traveled like wildfire as news throughout the land, because some of the teachings of the rabbis went like this. Healing a leper, as well as bringing someone back from the dead, is so difficult, it will only happen when Messiah comes. Okay, so that's part of their backdrop. So they would have utter confidence as they see Lazarus deteriorating, that Jesus can make a difference. But in their worldview, he has to be there physically to lay on his hands to make the thing work.
And interestingly, they would know where this fugitive was hanging out.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, they knew the general area in Perea, but if you look at the map, Perea is probably 8 miles wide and 50 miles long. So they're not exactly sure. Perea goes all the way on the east side of the Jordan from Jericho in the south, almost up to what's called Bethshan Scythopolis in the north, which is maybe 10 miles south of the Sea of Galilee. So it's a thin area, but it's a long area. And so they know generally where he is. And the messenger, by asking questions, once he gets across the Jordan River into Perea, can probably figure out, because Jesus always attracted a crowd and his notoriety spread. So what they say to the messenger is, you go find Yeshua and tell him that he whom you love is sick, which is, kind of a Jewish mama manipulative kind of phrase there, that sort of forced Jesus to respond as if he wouldn't anyway. And so eventually, after 2 days of walking, the messenger finds Jesus and says, the one who you love is sick and deteriorating. And Jesus says, okay, here's the message I want you to send back. You tell Mary and Martha that this is an illness that will not end in death. Okay? That happens to be a promise. And so then Jesus stays 2 more days in Perea. Luke tells us that in verses 6 of John 11. I'm sorry, John tells us that. So when Jesus heard that Lazarus was sick, he then stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Is that how you would respond to a dear friend who was dying of cancer in hospice?
Well, no, that would not be my first reaction. I would drop
everything.
Not
when you got the phone call that's saying he may not make it through the night.
Yeah.
And so, obviously, everything Jesus does is intentional, is deliberate, is purposeful. What we have here is deliberate delay, and which is very puzzling at this moment in time. And so the messenger starts back to Bethany, and in the interim period of time, Lazarus dies. Well, Mary and Martha would probably have reasoned, well, Jesus didn't make it here back in time before he died, but we know he can bring people back to life in the first day, the first 24 hours. We have 2 case histories of that. Surely that's what he's going to do. And The sun sets on the first day, and there's no Jesus. Well, Jesus, or Lazarus, is now prepared for burial. You have to be buried within 24 hours of death, wrapped and placed in a tomb. And now it's the beginning of the second day. No Jesus. And at the end of the second day, the messenger shows up and said, "Do I have great news?" Jesus said, Yeshua said, "This is a illness that will not end in death."
Hmm.
And how do you think Mary and Martha responded to that?
Shock. And dismay. And dismay.
Are you sure you heard him right?
Yeah.
You must have confused the message because he's
dead. Gotta be a mistake here.
Really? He said this is an illness that will not end in death. Huh. Well, the second day closes and the third day begins. And I'm sort of speculating at about the middle of the third day. I don't know whether it was Mary or whether it was Martha said, "I've got it figured out. I know what's going to happen." You know, in our Jewish worldview, we have this thing called the nefesh, which is the Hebrew word for soul. And it hovers over the body for the first 3 days. And it only leaves at the beginning of the fourth day, which is when terrible rapid decomposition sets in and the body is no longer realizable. I know what's going to happen. Jesus is going to get here before the end of the third day, and he's going to bring back now Lazarus to life before his nephesh departs. And this is going to be spectacular. Call the Jerusalem Post, call CNN, get a press conference scheduled. This is going to be the miracle of all miracles that Jesus is going to do.
Now, you've just described what was truly a cultural belief, that they really thought this, that the spirit, the nephesh, would hover around the body for 3 days. I mean, that to them was real life.
Yes, and you see from the perspective of the Jerusalem establishment, they cannot allow Jesus to be seen as Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to explain away these same day miracles that he's done for Jairus' daughter and for the only son of the widow of Nain. And so my guess is that's their rationale. Well, they really weren't dead. The nephesh really hadn't departed. They were just in a coma. And these really weren't bringing back to life miracles. He isn't Messiah. And so Jesus, knowing that, is going to say, "I'm going to give you a miracle that you can no longer deny."
Hmm.
If I bring back Lazarus on the fourth day, there will be no question that it's not the nephesh excuse. There will be no question that I am the Messiah. This will be like the Goodyear blimp flying over Jerusalem saying, "Jesus is Messiah, Yeshua is Messiah." And so that's exactly what I'm going to do. This is very deliberate delay. Even though it's going to disappoint my friends for 48 hours, this is what I need to do to reveal my glory. And the word glory here from a Hebrew perspective means to accurately reveal and portray. I'm going to accurately reveal and portray myself as the one who brings life after death.
Now, his disciples were perplexed at this point also, weren't they?
They were puzzled as to the delay. They didn't understand it, and they were even more puzzled when Jesus said, let's set our face towards Jerusalem. Basically, Thomas said, "You do that, you're going to die. You know, you're wanted all over the place." And this seals the deal for Jesus, by the way. There is no question he is Messiah. He is now on the most wanted posters all over the kingdom. Lazarus is wanted, dead or alive, because he is exhibit A, that Jesus is the Messiah.
Mm-hmm. Of course,
and
after
think about
resurrected.
That. Yeah. We keep thinking that the journey of faith is a pleasant one, and it's easy, and it should always be convenient. My goodness, does this complicate Lazarus' life.
Mm.
And it turns out he's going to be the only person in scriptures who has to die twice. He's fully immersed and centered in God's plan as well. And Mary and Martha are going to have to grieve again for Lazarus, even though they're perfectly centered in God's will as this unfolds. So there's lots of levels of insight and implication to this phenomenal miracle here. It's like 13.5 on the scale of 0 to 10 miracles for the Richter scale. And it seals the deal for Jesus. He's got to die because the ruling authorities here, the aristocracy said, Caiaphas says, if he keeps on like this, everyone is going to follow him. And there goes our franchise of Temple Mount. There goes our incredible cash cow. There goes our status. Rather one person die than that we lose our whole gig here running the temple system.
Mm-hmm. Well, so he heads back, heads uphill, and makes it back toward Bethany. Now, we still got some time if you'd like to go further with this, or do you think it's better to stop here?
Well, no, I think it still continues to be very instructional here because okay. Jesus works his way up the backside of the Wadi Kelt, up the backside, the eastern side of the Mount of Olives. He gets to the well, which is still, you can see there, at a place called Ein Shemesh. And there, Martha meets him first and says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And obviously, she did not listen to the promise that came with the messenger. This is an illness that will not end in death. And she takes it more from an eternal life perspective and says, yes, I realize that at some future point in time, we'll all be raised from the dead, those that follow you and believe in you. And Jesus basically said, no, I said now. And he chastises her a little bit. And he says, one of the seven I ams in John 11:25, I am the resurrection and the life. And let me just pause there for a moment. John is pretty old when he writes his gospel. He's the bishop of Ephesus. And has oversight for some Gentile house churches in Ephesus and some Jewish house churches, house fellowships, house churches in Ephesus. And so as he writes, he's very cognizant of the fact that he has two audiences, a Greek audience that is more philosophical and conceptual in nature, and he has a Jewish audience who's very behavioral in nature, non-philosophical, non-conceptual. And so while you will often hear sermon series preached on the seven I ams in John, just heard a couple more of them yesterday, almost never will you hear a series of seven sermons preached on the seven I do's of John. And this is one of the seven I am's and I do's. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. And the great I do he does is he brings back Lazarus from the dead. Now let's just pause on this fourth day thing for a moment. You may recall that I said in this Jewish worldview, by the beginning of the fourth day, the stench is so great, and that's actually recorded in the text. That's part of Mary and Martha's reaction, is you can't open that tomb. The stench will be awful. And the other part of their worldview is that the body will be in such a rapid state of decomposition, you cannot even recognize it anymore. So the analogy here, I think, for us to appreciate is that we live in a small community. Let's call it Baxter, Minnesota. And let's assume that the mayor of Baxter died 3 days ago, and that at the beginning of the fourth day, according to the will of the mayor, the family cremates the mayor, which we'll call Ole the mayor of Baxter. And so as the cremation process is unfolding, Jesus walks into the crematorium and stops by one of the chambers in the crematorium and says, Who's in there? And they said, well, that's the last remains of Ole. And Jesus says, open up the door. And Jesus peers into the still warm chamber, sees this 6-foot, 6-inch strip of ashes, maybe weighing 2 pounds at most, kind of a ribbon of ashes, and says, Ole, arise. And out of that pile of ashes emerges Ole, who crawls back out of the crematorium, and Jesus hugs him. That's the equivalent of bringing back someone back to life on the fourth day in this first century culture. It is beyond the pale. It is incomprehensible. It is something that cannot be imagined, and yet there it is. It just happened. And so this makes sure, remember the rabbi's teaching that bringing back someone from the dead is so difficult, it will only happen when Messiah comes. To bring someone back on the fourth day, there is no question that Jesus is the Messiah. And that's not lost on the establishment at all. And they pretty much say, he's got to go. Let's find a way to
kill. He had quite an audience there, too. And I think that had to be part of the plan.
Well, it would have spread like wildfire, mm-hmm. like the previous two case histories were, although this one was in even an order of magnitude more spectacular. And remember, this is just 40 days or so before the cross now. The word is spreading like wildfire, and so Jesus gets out of town. We're told in the gospel record he goes to Ephraim, which is a city of refuge, and then back into the Jordan Valley, back into Perea he goes with his disciples. And waiting about four more weeks before he ventures south again, enters Jericho, heals Bartimaeus from his blindness, calls Zacchaeus, and then goes up to Jerusalem for the last week of his life.
Is there significance to his going to a city of refuge? Because that's something that I wouldn't have known just from reading the text, that place was a city of refuge.
It's the Old Testament city of refuge, mm-hmm. in which I believe there were seven. Okay. And I think it fits because he's a fugitive now. With mm-hmm. what he's just done, they're after him.
Was he safe there?
He would have been. If you were able to go to one of these cities of refuge today, you're actually able to see all the interconnected subterranean hallways between homes, so to speak, mm-hmm. that you could shuffle people on the run from one place to another to be able to keep them from being caught by the authorities. So I think there's a lot of symbolism. Whether it actually was a city of refuge in the first century, I'm not so sure. But the symbolism of a city of refuge is very, very appropriate here. Mm-hmm.
Now, and of course, you've always told us that in the Jewish view, God is what God does. This was a hands-on, he's present experience that must have spoke loudly that this is God. This is the Messiah.
Absolutely. And remember, this is a Jewish world. Mm-hmm. And so it's far more impactful what he did than what he said. What he said will sink into people over time. But to these Jewish people, it's what Jesus did that matters, because God is what God does, and therefore Jesus must be God. He brings people back to life.
And he demonstrated he could do that from a distance. That had been done too. But in this case, he chose to be there and to do the physical act himself.
Absolutely.
It's an amazing story and an amazing series of events leading up to Passion Week, and we'll look forward to more. Got a little late start, so we didn't get as far as I would hope today, Doug, but next week we'll continue the march.
Well, let's just pause here and say sometimes the difficult delays that we deal with doesn't mean that they're still not part of God's plan. Mm. That his purpose is to glorify his name and his kingdom. It's not necessarily for our convenience, and sometimes we need that reminder. And we also see here, this is a God who can't be controlled. He can't be tamed. He does things that are beyond the pale. He is utterly surprising and unpredictable, to which I think we all can say, hallelujah.
David, any last thoughts or questions here?
Well, perhaps that you had a little trouble getting on today, and we joined you a little later. You joined us a little late. It just fits into the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of the whole deal.
I think so.
One final thought, and you know, not to take away, it's a detour. This is the first time that I've heard the reference that Jesus was wanted, and you offered the metaphor that you saw his poster up on the telephone poles. I'd never heard that before, but it makes intellectual sense, and it fits into the whole thing. Is that part of the reason that he drew crowds?
He drew crowds for multiple reasons. One was his authoritative teaching. Another was his ability to perform miracles. And for a small but presumably growing group of people, because he was seen as the actual Messiah, God's Messiah, who would come. So when you ask that question, you have to ask where in Jesus's three-year ministry is he, as to what's the appeal. But more and more as we approach Passion Week here, the perception is growing that he is Messiah, and that's going to lead us into a Palm Sunday discussion next week, where your question is going to really come to the forefront here. How are they seeing Jesus? What are they projecting onto him? And is there a revolution, a revolt about to spontaneously break out?
And you're saying this was about 40 days before the crucifixion when these events transpired. So much to learn. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow, Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. They've got a beautiful new website. You just need to know about that, and that's preservingbibletimes.org. And go there if you can. You can link to it from Broken Road Radio. And Doug, we as always enjoy your teaching, and thanks for showing up today. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Even though we got a delayed start, glad we can finish.
Yeah, we'll look forward to next week. Doug, have a great week, okay?
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Dick, see you, Doug. Dick Tunney at the piano.